Welcome to Canada's most irreverent talk show. This is The Andrew Lawton Show, brought to you by True North.
Hello and welcome to you all. This is another edition of Canada's most irreverent talk show here on True North. It is Tuesday, April 9th, 2024. We are doing things a little bit differently. We're doing the old, weird corner of a hotel room set that we have had to do on a few occasions. The rest of the week, we will be in an on-location studio, which is not based on like propping a laptop up on an ironing board, which sounds crazy, but I've often said in hotel rooms, ironing boards are the unsung hero of Zoom calls because it's like the only adjustable height surface you can find in here. So if you just find that the thing collapses in the middle of the show, that's probably why. But it seems to be working. I am in Ottawa right now where we are just on the eve of the Canada Strong and Free Network annual conference from which True North will be broadcasting live the rest of the week. Things get started there tomorrow afternoon and carry on until the weekend. We've got some great interviews planned, including with the former Prime Minister of Australia, Tony Abbott, and who else do we have? Some of our old friends, the cast of characters you see on the show, like Chris Sims and Aaron Woodrick, will be dropping by in person. We'll also hopefully find some current, former, and perhaps future politicians, and then we'll just basically grab anyone who looks interesting who happens to be walking by the studio. I say studio, by our booth. If they seem interesting, we'll grab them on. So if you are uninteresting and you walk back and forth like seven or eight times and we don't pull you in, I'm sorry, you just didn't make the cut. But do keep an eye out for that coverage from True North over the next few days. One thing I will also bring up here is that I know many of you were observing the great eclipse yesterday. Like I said, I'm in Ottawa, so we weren't in the path of totality, but I was still like panicking not to look up just accidentally. I was really tired yesterday. I didn't get a lot of sleep two nights ago. By the end of the day yesterday, my eyes were hurting because they had just been open for far too long. And I had that moment of panic of like, wait, did I look at the eclipse? Is this why? I was getting all paranoid. Do I have the long eclipse? Someone who does not have long eclipse is our good friend, Dr. Nili Kaplan-Mirth. I'm in her city, so I have to pay tribute to her. Nili Kaplan-Mirth is an Ottawa school trustee, and she had her eclipse goggles ready to go yesterday. She says in the post there, trying to troll the anti-science, what is it? The anti-science nitwits, because she has the Progress Pride flag, the eclipse glasses, and the N95 mask while she is outside. Now, the joke is on her because I suspect she'll be wearing those eclipse glasses basically for the next 10 years anytime she is stepping outside. So that's something that we should definitely keep an eye out, no pun intended for there. Let me just bring up first and foremost here why I think we are missing the boat on a lot of what government's doing. So the big climate change file is one that, according to some activists, the federal government is not spending enough money on. Yeah, this was a story that True North has kept an eye on. I saw it in the Toronto Star. Now, their framing of this is a little bit different than what perhaps your and my framing would be. But there's a research company that focuses on sustainable finance, the sustainable economy. It's called Corporate Knights. I hadn't heard of it before they came out with this report saying that the Liberal government has spent I think it was about $39 billion on climate change stuff in the last 9 years. $39 billion fighting against climate change. And you may think, oh, wow, that sounds like a lot of money. I'm glad they're calling the government out on that. Oh, no. They're saying that is just a drop in the bucket. The government should have been spending more, and the government has only spent about 70% of what it said it was going to spend. So their issue is that the federal government has spent not enough, that they've only spent this money on climate change, and they're actually short by about $14 billion. So they need to throw more money at the weather, more money on this file, so that they will be able to do what exactly? Change the weather? Is that kind of the goal they're after here? So we will perhaps see what on earth they are attempting to do in due course. But again, I have no doubt that the government will continue to spend the money because this is the activist set to whom the government is very much beholden, more than taxpayers. affairs. And in the budget that's coming up, Chrystia Freeland and Justin Trudeau have not committed to there being no new taxes. They say there won't be new taxes for the middle class, but they aren't saying there won't be new taxes in general. And I think this is something that we always need to keep an eye on, because definitions matter. What they define as middle class and what they define as being wealthy and subject to increased taxation may differ from what ordinary Canadians who are forced to deal with the rising cost of living have to say about these questions. So that's definitely something that we should be watching here on the upcoming budget. And I would also point out that the government is still not dealing with the very imminent and immediate relief that people are seeking from it when it comes to the carbon tax. And I know this has been like the broken record subject. We've had carbon tax stories on the show most days, most weeks for the last several months, because there was obviously a big lead up to this. The Conservatives decided to make this their hill to die on. There was that glimmer of hope when everyone took to the streets on April 1st across the country. And in Alberta, as my colleague Rachel Emanuel has been reporting, they are still protesting about a week and a half on this increase to the carbon tax. They're out there all over the province, and it's been going on for several, for over a week now. But all of that is to say the government has been unflinching on this. They have decided to make the carbon tax their hill to stand on. It was a weird one for the Liberal government to have some little bit of round of principles on, but they've decided to stick firm on this and continue defending that carbon tax. Now, what's been interesting to see is the erosion of federalism here. Now, provincial premiers are supposed to have, in theory, a co-equal relationship with the federal government. It's not that the federal government is overseeing provinces. It's that the federal government has its area of jurisdiction. The provincial governments have their area of jurisdiction. And the prime minister is really supposed to be the first among equals in a lot of ways, where they will have first minister's meetings. First minister's meetings means that the premiers and the prime minister. So I should actually point out here, in French, premier and prime minister are the same. It's premier ministre. So premier and prime minister are actually the same role. You could call Justin Trudeau the premier of Canada. You could call Doug Ford the prime minister of Ontario. We don't, but those terms actually used to be more interchangeable, certainly more than they are today. We're in Quebec, Quebec's the only province that calls both the premier ministre. But the reason I bring that up is that Justin Trudeau believes the provinces are there to do his bidding. When he wants to impose a carbon tax, he looks to the provinces and says, you guys have to fall in line on this. And I think that's incredibly dangerous, because right now you have six premiers that are saying, we want a first minister's meeting. We want all the first ministers of this country to come together, all 14, 10 provinces, three territories, one federal government. We want them all to come together and have it out over this carbon tax. Let's have an emergency meeting. And Justin Trudeau's answer to this is, we already did this, didn't we? We did. When did we do it? 2016. So 8 years ago, you had a meeting, discussed the carbon tax. And by the way, changes of government have been mounting since then. Alberta has gone through two premiers since then. Every province has had one, in some cases, two elections since then. And we're supposed to just be happy that, we already talked about that. It's a fait accompli. It's done. Yeah, it's done. No point in discussing it further. Well, that's not cutting it for many of the provincial governments in this country. And, you know, the reason that this has been such an interesting tactic from the Conservatives is because the Liberals are still with the NDP trying to have the discussion about anything other than what ordinary Canadians are having it about. So you may have seen over the weekend, True North ran a story about this. Alex Jones, who is the head of InfoWars, decided to have some kind words to say about Pierre Poilievre. Now, it was kind of reported by some people as an endorsement. It really wasn't a formal endorsement. It was a vote of confidence. It was an endorsement in the broad sense, but not like a, I hereby declare I throw my support behind this guy. But he had put out a tweet when he said, yeah, I've been following this guy for a while. He's the real deal. And oh man, the Liberal machine just like went apoplectic on this, including outgoing New Democrat MP Charlie Angus.
This government promised to ban the AR-15. That's the weapon that was used to murder 26-year-old children at Sandy Hook. And yet on Thursday, the Conservative leader was tweeting that the government wasn't going after the AR-15, but hunting rifles. So little wonder he gets endorsed by Alex Jones, who's notorious for taunting families and children murdered by buy the AR-15. So will the minister confirm, is the government going after hunting rifles or the AR-15, or is this the conservative leader being the, quote, real deal of disinformation for the likes of Alex Jones?
The Honourable Minister of Public Service, or Public Safety.
Mr. Speaker, I want to thank my colleague for his question and salute his long service in this House on behalf of the people of Nova Ontario. Mr. Speaker, I've never had that much applause, Mr. Speaker, in the House before. Mr. Speaker, I share our colleague's concern about the Conservative policy with respect to gun control. We have said from the beginning, law-abiding hunters and sportspersons are not the subject of these regulations. Mr. Speaker, what we're doing is taking away guns that were designed to kill people on the battlefield, and we're also prepared to compensate the people that bought those guns lawfully. It's something the Conservative Party will undo, and we're committed to keeping Canadians safe.
It's something the Conservative Party will undo. The Conservatives all should have said "hear, hear" when he said that. He was just setting them up for it. It's a weird thing, because the Liberals love talking about this issue. The NDP and them are great partners on this. They can talk about assault rifles, assault guns. One of my colleagues points out the usage of the word "sports persons." Yeah, you can't say sportsman anymore. It's sports persons, sports people kind, and all of that. But the reality is, it's hilarious when Dominic LeBlanc, the public safety minister there, says this is not going after people who are law-abiding gun owners, and then, we're compensating people who bought these guns lawfully. Wait, so you're admitting that people who bought these guns lawfully are being targeted by the so-called gun buyback, because it's only the people that bought them lawfully that have to turn those guns into the government. So it's a weird inconsistency. And just to contrast it with yesterday's show, when I spoke to the new CFO, the new Chief Firearms Officer of Saskatchewan, as well as the Firearms Commissioner, that is Murray Cowan and Robert Freeburg, respectively. And they were talking about how their province has decided to put the law-abiding gun owners, that community in Saskatchewan, front and center with their approach. You contrast that with the federal government, where everything is about the way to antagonize lawful gun owners and also gun businesses. And this has been something I've been harping on for quite some time. You may have seen, I did a documentary a couple of years back called Assaulted, Justin Trudeau's War on Gun Owners. And in that, one episode was devoted to gun businesses, people that set up shop, they did everything right, they play by the rules, and they were saddled with, in some cases, hundreds of thousands of dollars in inventory, which still, after 4 years, they have been unable to do anything with because of this gun reclassification and the inability for the government to put its so-called buyback into force. Now, one of the techniques that the government was going to do was working with firearms industry members, working with firearms stores, and find a way to get these businesses to be able to offload their inventory legally. Now, this was something that they had worked out a deal with the Canadian Sporting Arms and Ammunition Association, and actually the CSAAA got a fair bit of pushback from some members of the gun community for agreeing to be a part of this, and I want to get to that in this interview here. But the president of the Canadian Sporting Arms and Ammunition Association, Wes Winkle, has said it's clear the government is in over its head here. They bit off more than it's could chew. Take your cliche, put it there. It fits. The government just is floundering and doesn't know what to do to make up for this ambitious goal it set out now, again, almost 4 years ago to the day. Wes Winkle joins us again. Good to talk to you again, Wes. Thanks for coming on today. Oh, I'm not hearing you there. I think you might be muted.
Oh, this is okay.
I hear you now.
You hear me now? Okay.
So let me just start off with some of the criticism that you've got, because I know there have been a number of gun activists that I believe operate in good faith, that when your organization agreed to work with the government on this, thought that it was akin to selling out.
Absolutely. Yeah, we were aware that we were going to receive some pushback on it. We're in a real catch-22. We have businesses that have these firearms registered to their inventory. These firearms are not saleable. They are very expensive to insure. They've been stuck for a long time as unsaleable inventory. And we have a lot of members that are trying to find a way to get their capital out of them and reinvest it in other parts of our industry and to try to keep their businesses going. We, of course, as an association and as business owners, want nothing more for this law to be reversed and just to be allowed to sell our inventory again. But there's a reality that businesses have to deal with. And right now, that reality is we can't do that. So we've always, as an industry group, have asked the federal government to consult us on any laws or policy or any change to policy. And in this case, when they reached out and asked us to consult, it's very difficult to ask to be consulted and then to turn around and thumb your nose when you're asked. So we had a vote as a board of directors and had a unanimous agreement that we would enter into discussions and try to negotiate the best deal we could inside of a terrible situation. And that's kind of where we're at. We have no interest or any part of wanting to assist the government in buying back individuals' guns or to get in the way of a gun confiscation program with people that own these firearms at home and want to keep them. We have nothing to do with that. This is just strictly to deal with the dealer's inventory. And for those that don't realize, this is all registered in ledgers. It's something that everyone knows what we have. And it's when the amnesty expires, they have to be dealt with. And these businesses already, we've seen so many go out of business. We're just trying to help some of these businesses that are floundering with this inventory.
And I know there was reporting of the value of this agreement. That was not money that your organization was receiving from the government, correct?
Correct. Yeah, we again, didn't want our businesses to have to pay for doing any of the federal government's legwork. Well, we are liaisoning with the businesses to try to assist them in this venture. But at the same time, we didn't want them to have to pay for it through the association's donations or money. So we only agreed to do it if the government would recompensate us for all of our expenses in this project. So that's where the total contract value was posted of what could possibly the expenses get up to. But we're only getting reimbursed for our expenditures.
So to bring it outside of your organization specifically here and talk about the effect on businesses, how are the business owners on this? Because I know some are fire-breathing activists that are saying, you know, they're kind of like the cold dead hands types that just want to fight this tooth and nail, whereas others, I suspect, are like you just described. They're like, listen, I just want to run my business. As it stands right now, I can't do anything with this inventory, so I want to offload it. Is there a bit of a split there?
Well, there is definitely a little bit of a split there. There's a faction of businesses, and we knew that that they existed. And, you know, it's one of those things where it's a divisive subject for us because we have to go with what the majority of businesses in our feedback wanted. And, you know, there are some that are that cold, dead hands mantra. And I understand it. And to be honest, I commend them on their conviction on it. But at the same point, we have businesses that have extremely large volumes of this inventory, whether they be distributors that had hundreds of thousands of dollars or manufacturers that had hundreds of thousands of dollars, these inventory that just don't have the ability to say, I can't participate in this. They need a way to get out of this. Like I said, we've had businesses that have reported that just to insure this inventory has cost them $20,000 a year. So obviously we have that, large disclaimer where we have that problem. So yeah, we've definitely tried to get the best deal we can for those businesses involved. And yeah, there's some that were unhappy and they want us to never have a conversation with the federal government. And we understand that. We're very frustrated with the amount of attack we've received from this current federal government. But at the same time, it's hard to become an industry representative or a lobby group if you refuse to talk to the people in charge. So it's a catch-22.
When I did my documentary about this a couple of years ago, there was one store owner I spoke to. It was in Peterborough or just outside. And I can't remember the name of the business, but the gentleman I spoke to was Jeff Toombs. And one of the things that he had shared, which I thought was incredibly concerning, was that the initial order in council came out in May of 2020. He immediately pivots and says, okay, we're going to buy a bunch of this other gun that's kind of similar that people will like. And then 2 weeks later, that one's also prohibited. So he attempts to get around the one issue that the government has created. And in the end, he's doubled his problems here. Has the government expressed any contrition for just how arbitrary this is and how dangerous it is for business owners that actually don't know how to navigate around this when even things they do to try to adapt and mitigate end up screwing them even further?
And they have not. I mean, this is part of the real problem with the legislation that Minister Blair brought forward back in the day, is that through the order in council and then the subsequent legislation, you're banning a style of firearm. So there's no mechanical definition for what is prohibited. And therefore, it's an arbitrary decision by a panel of people. And it's very difficult for us to know as an industry what is and what is not going to be prohibited. When you start saying stuff like of modern design and stuff like that, like what does that mean? And nobody really knows. And we have some very interesting discussion topics inside here of whether a firearm will be allowed or not. And then there's times where we get notification that it's classified as non-restricted, which means we can sell it. And then it changes again down the road when there's more volume of this gun getting imported. So it's a very difficult business environment. And then what happens, of course, is our manufacturers that spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to pivot and to try to produce something for the Canadian market that's viable and legal, and then it gets prohibited as well, they give up on trying to design guns for the Canadian market. And again, that makes it very hard for our retailers to find product that we can sell legally to hunters and to target shooters that want to participate in the sports. So it's been extremely difficult. Canada has been a very frustrating thing for our manufacturers, and a lot of them have just given up and turned their back on us as a country because they don't know how to participate in our market anymore.
One thing that I wanted to ask about that as well, and people that aren't gun owners may not realize this, but a gun is not just a gun. I mean, a gun can oftentimes be a base unit that people add a whole bunch of stuff to and modify. I mean, for example, the much maligned AR-15, one of the reasons that gun is so appealing, that style of gun, it's not one model, is because it's modular and people will, you know, buy different parts for it. And when we talk about this in the context of the buyback, one of the points you raised, and I read this in a piece by Brian Passafume in the National Post, was that the government didn't even seem to realize that complexity with this and just how many thousands and thousands of parts there are that also may or may not fall under this buyback. And it's not even quite clear if they do.
Well, for sure. And again, with the bureaucrats involved in the system, how could they have known? They weren't experts in this field. And, you know, when the government did the knee-jerk reaction to bring this order in council forward, and Minister Blair, there was no consultation beforehand, because it was a knee-jerk reaction and a very fast order in council brought forward. So without consultation and understanding the topic that they're bringing legislation in on, I actually feel for the bureaucrats in the system that are trying to navigate it afterwards, because they get thrown a terrible file and say, clean this up. And it really isn't that easy to clean up. And now we're all, as a industry and as a level of bureaucrats, everyone's trying to clean up the mess that Minister Blair made.
So, I mean, we can't talk about this without addressing the political elephant in the room, which is that there could be an election theoretically at any point. There's scheduled to be an election by October of 2025. From your knowledge of this process, will this gun buyback even be in place and buying back? Again, I hate that term, but will that even be happening by October 2025?
I would anticipate with the steps that have been put forward that there will be firearms purchased from businesses by that point in time. I believe that will happen. The one from the individuals, the guns that are in people's houses, I believe that that is a way more convoluted process. They're so spread out in a country as rural as Canada. I don't believe that process gets going by that point in time. I think that's why you've seen the amnesty get pushed out past the election. I think when you've seen the amnesty date announced, it's doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that this will probably be an election issue. You know, I think you'll have the Liberals saying, hey, you know, if you vote blue, that, this big, bad firearm would be back out in society. And, I'm sure that's what the plan is, and, vice versa for the other side. But, the reality is that these firearms have been stayed in people's cabinets from the day that they were prohibited. They have never left there. There's been, of course, no crimes committed with them. So it is all political posturing. That's all it is. We know that as an industry, we've been a pawn in the politics game for a long time. And it's frustrating for those of us in business trying to keep people employed and trying to make a living.
Wes Winkle, president of the Canadian Sporting Arms and Ammunition Association. Thanks so much for coming on today, Wes. Good to talk to you.
Thank you for the time. We appreciate it.
All right, thank you. And I would just encourage to give the shameless plug again. You can check out my documentary on this, Assaulted, Justin Trudeau's War on Gun Owners. It is a couple years old now, but still just as fresh, although some of the problems are even more acute. There have been no resolutions, just more problems than that. And as mentioned, one of the episodes dealt specifically with businesses. We also did an episode on competitive sport shooters, which was quite interesting. We did four parts. What were the other parts? One, I think, which is focused on crime. And a lot of the law enforcement angle, and maybe I need to watch it again because I've now forgotten what it was about. So we had a fourth part that was about, that was the same as the other one. I don't know. We'll figure it out, but it was a fun series. I'm glad to do it, and I've had a few people reach out and say it might be worth doing a sequel to that. So we will perhaps try and put something together, see what else there is to cover on that. But I wanted to shift gears from one hot button issue to another. We have seen over the weekend the 6-month anniversary of Hamas's horrific attacks on Israel and the subsequent traumatizing of the Jewish people across the world, including in Canada. Now, just to put a fine point on this, I saw yesterday, just in my travels in Ottawa, a member of parliament who is from the Jewish community, who has, not in cabinet, not the prime minister, obviously, who had a police escort, which is something that in this country we have not seen on just regular old members of parliament, certainly in my lifetime. And the distinction is, and this has been reported on, several members of the Jewish community who are members of parliament have police details because it is otherwise not safe to be walking around this country as a Jew. And that is a terrifying reality. Jewish businesses have been vandalized. And yes, there have been attacks in this country on Muslims as well. Horrific attacks. One in my own city, where a terrible, terrible, vile, evil piece of human filth decided to target a Muslim family for no other reason than he wanted to kill Muslims. He's now behind bars, which people would say is actually getting off easy. And there's a part of me that's inclined to agree with that, as much as my position on the death penalty is a little bit more complicated. And then you had that horrific attack on a Quebec mosque some years back as well. So this is not to say that one group has a monopoly on being targeted and persecuted, but it is to say that these sorts of attacks have very political implications in how they are reported. And this was put front and center by a very thoughtful and detailed analysis that was published by the Aristotle Foundation. It was written by Rahim Mohammed, who is a columnist with the National Post. He's got a PhD. He's a very well-educated guy. Also very entertaining on Twitter. You should definitely give Rahim a follow there if you're not already. But he joins me on the line now. Rahim, good to talk to you. Thanks for coming on today.
Andrew, great to see you. I saw you were involved in Jamil's swearing in the other day. Jamil Jaivani, a mutual friend. Very cool.
Yes, I had the. I haven't actually mentioned it to the audience. I had the privilege yesterday. That's why I came up to Ottawa a bit earlier, being the MC for Jamil's swearing in yesterday. I've known Jamil, and we worked in a number of capacities before he was a political candidate. So it was a great honor to be involved in that. And I was actually quite pleased that when I was MCing him, Justin Trudeau didn't just like intervene and have the swearing in canceled. So Jamil still gets to be a member of parliament. But Rahim, you have taken a very controversial research question here. And I was hoping you could explain it in your own words first, what you set out to look at, and then, of course, what you found.
Sure. So backing up a little bit, Canada, which is historically, I think it's fair to say, had a Christian heritage, it's becoming an increasingly pluralistic country religiously. According to the last census that was taken in 2021, we're at the point where about 50% of Canadians are Christian. And the other 50% either identify with no religion or another religion. So I think as Canada becomes more religiously pluralistic, it's all the more important that you have strong norms and maintain strong norms of interfaith relations and interfaith civility. So one way that's been expressed in the past, so as you mentioned, Andrew, in your own hometown of London, Ontario, that terrible truck attack against that Pakistani Muslim family during the Quebec City Mosque attack. It's been a custom, and I think an important one for religious groups from across the spectrum, be they Jewish, Hindu, Christian, whatever, to put out a press release after something like that happens, that will say, we stand with the Muslim community, we stand against religious hatred and religious violence in all forms. So we saw that, thankfully, after the Quebec City mosque shooting. We saw that after the London, Ontario truck attack. October the 7th has been a different story. And I think it's fair to say the circumstances are somewhat different with October the 7th. It is an attack that took place on foreign soil, and fair enough, but a number of Canadians were killed on October the 7th. And a few of these were Canadians that were actively working with Palestinian groups as part of the peace process in Gaza. Others were young Canadians in their 20s that were there for the music festival in southern Israel. So the fact that we haven't seen much in the way of condemnation or much in the way of regret from the Muslim community, organized Muslim groups in Canada, surrounding, if not the attack, the loss of Canadian life, and the many more Canadians who lost members of their extended families on October the 7th, I don't think that bodes well for religious pluralism and where interfaith relations are in Canada at present.
And just to put a fine point on this, you're contrasting that with the fact that overwhelmingly Jewish groups, and you list, who was in your sample here, sure, were condemning those Quebec City and London, Ontario incidents almost unanimously.
Sure. So even an organization like CJA, the Canadian Association of Jewish Affairs, which I would say is fairly, Zionist, if you want to use that word, pro-Israel, right after Quebec City, they put out a statement right after the London, Ontario truck attack, within 24 hours, they put out a statement condemning each attack and condemning violence against Muslim Canadians. So they're able to separate, violence on Muslim Canadians from the situation in the Middle East. And unfortunately, again, the details somewhat different in October the 7th. It's nevertheless been somewhat underwhelming that very few organized Muslim groups have put out statements, either one condemning Hamas or at the very least expressing their condolences to those who lost family members during the October the 7th attack. So, go ahead.
No, I agree with your core conclusion, because I think there is a double standard here. I have a slight issue with the methodology in the sense that not only was October 7th on foreign soil, and I think your caveat that Canadians were involved is valid, but there's also a much greater political context to Hamas-Israel violence than I would say there is in an attack by a lone wolf in London, Ontario, or by one in Quebec City. And maybe I'm just curious your thought about that, because you must have considered it, that it's there are political stakes that are different when you're commenting on anything to do with Israel that aren't there with a terrorist attack in Canada.
So what I'd point to is the scale of October the 7th, 1,100. So I believe about 3,000 American civilians were killed on September the 11th. So you're talking about scales, in the thousands. And you talk about something like September 11th, 2001. Intellectually, I understand the geopolitical dynamics that would lead to an attack on a major American target. I think that's totally different from the 3,000 innocent civilians that lost their lives on September the 11th. And I would say the same about October the 7th. I understand the geopolitical dynamics at play. I understand the complexities of the Israel-Hamas conflict. That doesn't mean that, anything will justify the targeting civilians, and that doesn't in any way diminish the pain of people here in Canada who've lost family members and friends on October the 7th. And I think at the very least, that grief and that suffering should be acknowledged as part of interfaith relations, as part of cordiality between religious communities here in Canada.
No, I think that's an incredibly well-made and it's a well-taken point as well. And just looking outside of the event-specific observations here, I remember when M103 came up, which was the anti-Islamophobia motion that was a debate, I think it was about five or 6 years ago. One of the things that was interesting there was a lot of Jewish groups really stood shoulder to shoulder with Muslim groups that are saying, yes, we need to combat Islamophobia. And then when the discussion shifted to anti-Semitism, a lot of that reciprocity was not there. And certainly in the last 6 months hasn't been.
Yeah, I mean, that's a little before my time, to be honest. I was in the United States, so I remember tangentially that was going on, but I didn't pay too close attention to that whole debate.
Fair enough. And I guess I would ask what you'd think would happen if you expanded this outside of these, casualty events with casualties, and looked even at smaller scale incidences like vandalism against mosques and synagogues. Because without having looked at it from a data perspective, it does seem like there's a great political imbalance in, you know, which ones attract the attention of national media, which ones attract the attention of, you know, the tweet from Justin Trudeau, for example.
So is it True North that's been tracking church arsons, vandalism?
Yeah, my colleague Cosman Georgia has as well. And we're up to well over 100 now.
Yeah.
Vandalism and arsons against churches.
You know, heard maybe a handful of stories about that. I remember, I think it might have been Jerry Butts tweeting something to the effect of, I understand what would make someone want to burn down a church, but at the same time, you know. I have noticed, and I think it's sort of, It plays into this sort of EDI framework in which we see Jewish communities and Christian communities as somewhat privileged. And, you know, by virtue of that privilege, essentially asking for acts of intimidation, acts of vandalism, acts of hatred. I do agree with you that there's been a substantial imbalance, and that church arson story has been incredibly underreported. One of the few times I've actually remember a church arson get a substantial amount of attention in the media was when it was a Coptic Christian church of that of mostly Egyptian Christian parishioners, in which you did have that sort of minoritized follower or that minoritized parishioner base. So I will say I agree with you 100% that I think the reportings of when you see these actions targeting mosques or synagogues or churches, it has been inconsistent. Not that any of those things are okay.
To bring it back to your analysis from the Aristotle Foundation, I know you're looking at the data, not necessarily the motivations behind it, but just, you know, taking your political mind, which I think is certainly a superb one. Anyone who's read your column could say, do you think the motivation here is just a deep ideological view that these organizations hold, or do you think it's a part of their own coalition and not wanting to alienate constituencies they have that make up part of their supporters for whom this will be an issue?
Yeah. And I mean, one thing I will say is you've seen a lot of migration to Canada over the past 20 or so years from the Middle East. Barbara Kay has a great article about this, about how this relates to Quebec and Quebec wanting to stay French. And, you know, due to colonial dynamics, a number of pockets of the Middle East and North Africa have sizable communities that are Francophone. So I think you are looking at leaderships within Muslim organizations. You have different, I think, values among the first wave of Muslim immigrants. My parents came over from Uganda, we're a smiling Muslim, we be part of it. And some of the newer arrivals from, let's say, 1995 to present. And I do think part of the story are these associations, which, you know, rely on donations, rely on maintaining and cultivating active membership bases, attempting to keep those bases together when you have potentially a plurality of viewpoints toward, you know, do we embrace a more Western pluralistic view of values, or a more more of a hardline approach?
Yeah, years ago, I was in Israel, and I was doing it wasn't a formal interview, but I was doing a round table, and there was a Palestinian radio host, and I was a radio host in Canada at the time, so I was interested in his analysis. And he had, at the time, it was 2015, there had been this spate of knife attacks against Israelis. And, you know, he had said, oh, yeah, he did a call-in show on his radio program in which he asked, is it okay to stab Jews in the streets? And which is like a strange question that you would never ask on a Canadian radio
program. Well, yeah, that, is it okay to punch a white supremacist? Remember that?
And he was
2017.
Like, and he was proud to tell me, he's like, oh, but most said no. And I'm like, So there is a constituency that would call into radio and say, stabbing an Israeli is fine. And that has stayed with me, because when you talk about this, it's like even a small contingent of these of any community can have tremendous influence on these things. So when it comes to like not condemning a horrific attack that killed 1,200 Israelis and non-Israelis, as you've pointed out, I think that's incredibly noteworthy. Well, we have a news report up about it at True North, but you can read their report for yourself over at the Aristotle Foundation. The author, Rahim Muhammad. Great talking to you, sir. We'll see you soon.
I'll see you tomorrow in Ottawa, I hope. I'm going to be there.
All right, I hope so. Thank you. Thank you for that. We'll have to pull you to our little booth and do an in-person chat then.
Wonderful. Looking forward to it.
All right. Thanks very much, Raheem Mohammed. Well, that's it for us for today. I will be live tomorrow, same time, different place on the Andrew Lawton Show, but stay tuned. We'll talk to you then. Thank you. God bless, and good day to you all.
Thanks for listening to the Andrew Lawton Show. Support the program by donating to True North at www.tnc.news.